Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The cow from KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have as my guest someone I always enjoy talking to, and that is Ian McEwan. The new novel is called Solar. It's published by Doubleday over at the Nanay Talese imprint, and the hero of this book is Michael Beard. He is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who, for the worst reasons, becomes involved with solar energy. He has not particularly believed any of the guff, but now he is a convert. And the book seems to be about not solar energy, but morality. Am I right?
That's correct, Michael. He's a scoundrel in the, I guess, the mode of Falstaff, who casts a very long, wide shadow over this kind of hero. He is a man who probably I've heaped practically every human weakness upon. I hope that it's a sort of reflection on human nature and the difficulty of reconciling our cleverness with our stupidity. And for that reason, therefore, he has to make a journey from being profoundly skeptical about climate change to becoming a passionate but highly self-interested advocate as he takes on this new technology of photosynthesis. He's stolen the work of a student postdoc who's died, and he's now running with these ideas. He's got 17 patents and an American associate, and the novel really traces his line towards a small town in the boot heel of New Mexico called Lordsburg, where I've actually been, a lovely place actually. And there, all his past and all his indiscretions and chaos catch up with him.
Now, this book tends toward farce in a way that I don't think any of the others have. There's a high level of, I've got very good news, he says at one point. The end of the world is not going to not happen.
Yes, his friend gets a bit worried. His associate, Toby, gets a bit worried that perhaps the earth is cooling and perhaps it's not going to happen. And he says, relax, it's a catastrophe. You know? No problem. Yes, I mean, he's not a good guy. And one of the reasons I chose to put this in more of a comic vein was partly the wish to seduce the reader into spending time with someone whom they might not normally like to. And comedy is a way of actually doing that. In many cases, he's the comic victim rather than the instigator. And I suppose, just to take up your question of whether this is a book about morals, I decided to have spend some time and some fun having a little tease of various other things like British press or the press generally, certain kind of corners of postmodern scholarship, one or two other targets along the way. And I hope that people will engage with it as partly a novel of ideas, partly a serious reflection on climate change and where it's leading us or where we're leading it. And partly, I hope, as an entertainment.
Well, it is very entertaining and instructive. Now, tell me, how do you go about learning about the things a scientist thinks?
Well, I hang around with a lot of scientists. I went to the lab you have here in the States in Golden, Colorado, just outside Denver, the National Renewable Energy Lab. So I suppose I have a taste for science. I like it. I like the company of scientists. I find that too much time in the company of liberal humanists like you and me can be a bit depressing, because we find pessimism rather intellectually delicious and we tend to wallow in it. Many of my scientist friends are people who certainly will concede that there's a problem in this direction or that, but they want to solve it. And liberal humanists don't want to solve it. We just want to kind of wallow in it.
Well, one of the lovely things about the last two novels is that at crucial points, poetry comes to the aid of the narrators. In this one, it's John Milton. In the last, it was Matthew Arnold, if I remember correctly.
That's right. Yes, Michael Beard seduces his first wife by boning up on everything he could find out about John Milton in a week. He's never really heard of John Milton before. He knows it's her special subject. He knows that she, as a literature student, would look down on him because he's doing something boring, a non-subject like physics. So he hears from a friend that her special subject is Milton, and he decides, well, he'll just get all the books on Milton and read them. And to his astonishment, he finds a lot of it's very boring, but there's nothing particularly very difficult to understand. He reads all the major essays on Milton, and he's astonished. He's always been intimidated by the arts types. They always look down on him, rather. Now he realizes that in their tutorials, there's nothing really very difficult to understand, and nothing of the kind that he and his colleagues have to confront daily as they get their minds round the Dirac equation or Einstein's general theory, which he feels like describing as almost like a weightlifting session, and takes many, many attempts before you can finally understand it. And I suppose I use this comic episode to give a voice to a slightly indefensible position, which is that I think that there's something fraudulent about the study of literature in universities, that actually we could all be studying science and do literature on the side. When I was teaching at Caltech, many of the very brightest kids there are doing physics and maths, but they just take an English degree to keep themselves entertained. It's a kind of finishing school, I think, that we've all been to and kids still go to.
Here is Michael Beard. He's been a Nobel laureate. He has, in a sense, devoted the latter part of his life to getting married again and again and again and again and again. He's been through five marriages. He's betrayed each of these wives with other women. He has come to regard the marriages as being like tides going in and out, one coming in while the other is going out. And he doesn't really do physics anymore. He attends symposia. He represents his award, and he represents his inheritance from Einstein.
That's correct. He got his Nobel Prize back in the 80s for modifying some Einstein's work. And so in all the textbooks now, you'll find, at least in this fictional world, the Beard-Einstein conflation. And like a lot of physicists and mathematicians who have Nobel Prizes, get them in their 60s, 50s and 60s, his best work is far behind him. You peak in math pretty early on, I mean, like an athlete. I was at a conference, climate change conference in Germany, and met a lot of Nobel Prize winners who, again, all men, but real alpha males, you know, sort of bristling egos of a sort. And it was that point I thought, when I get a character emerging from the mists, and if I write this novel about climate change, I'm going to give him a Nobel Prize, precisely because of this rather the comic lapse that exists between the achievement so far away and then the power that accrues to a man who might run a department or raise millions for satellites and so on.
I'm talking to Ian McEwan about his novel Solar. It's published by Doubleday, and it takes the scientist's life and, in a sense, pits it against an implicit world of liberal humanist morals. He is not having any, in a sense. He sleeps with other women while married. He betrays most of the people he knows. And his instincts, we learn that he has the aggressive instinct of someone well chosen in the social Darwinist race. He knows what to do when he finds a dead body, so that he will not be thought to be the killer of said body. He knows how to displace it to his own advantage, and he works really fast. Now, mightn't it be that the laziness of the social sciences, of the literatures, is something that gives us back a little bit of the old-fashioned sense of we're here to enjoy the planet or delight one another?
I think you might well be right. People who are overactive caused a lot of who are very clever and overactive caused a lot of problems in the 20th century, especially once intellectuals get in power. Cleverness never seems to rescue anyone from great folly. In fact, I know, and you must know, some very, very clever people, and their lives can be incredibly messy. In other words, there's a special kind of stupidity that only very clever people are capable of. And Michael Beard is really one of those. I mean, but I also think, you know, one weakness of his we haven't discussed is his greed. I mean, he is an addict for junk food. He's a consumer on a gargantuan scale. He puts on weight through the novel. He's 15 pounds overweight when the novel begins, 35 pounds. It goes up to 65 pounds by the time he goes to see his doctor.
When we first discover how completely dexterous a scoundrel he is, it's simultaneous with our discovery of how completely dexterous a scoundrel the author is as well. Michael Beard's cunning substitution of cause and effect and the thrusting guilt, I don't want to give too much away, onto a party he dislikes.
His wife's lover, we can say that.
We can say that, okay.
He affects some revenge on his wife's lover by sending him to prison for 16 years for a crime that he didn't commit.
But is that kind of quick mitwittedness like the way a novelist plots?
In a sense, you plot a novel by writing it. That's the only way to plot it, or at least it's the only way for me to plot it. I could never have written out this plot, and I have to say this is probably the most intricate plot I've ever devised. I could never have written this out in advance. I wouldn't have had the sense of it. But one thing leads to another. So when I have Michael Beard come back from the Arctic and discover his wife's lover in the house, it was only by having him come back that I found the lover in the house. Then I thought what to do with him. One thing happens, one thing leads to another in this way. So what you can't call it is quick, because these things take 2 or 3 years to unfold. So it's the reading time is very, very different from the writing time.
Well, I noticed that I was being asked as a reader to sympathize repeatedly with this rather moralless man, particularly when he's gone to the North Pole. He has been swaddled in a thermal. What is such a suit called?
It's called a snowmobile suit. If you ride a snowmobile in minus 45 degrees, you need some very, very thick protection. And under that snowmobile suit, you have loads of other layers, layer after layer after layer inside there, plus a balaclava. But inside the balaclava is another lining, and goggles and thick gloves and liners for gloves, a huge amount of gear. And it's a piece of knockabout, really. But Michael Beard gets onto this snowmobile. There's a storm coming. They've got to make a big journey across the ice. And he suddenly realized he got out of bed in the morning in a rush and didn't have a pee. So he has to face the elements, expose himself to the elements with some near disastrous consequences.
Well, to begin with, he has to pull off his gloves. His hands immediately go numb. He has to find zipper after zipper for layer after layer after layer and find that tool that will inevitably get caught on the sub-freezing zipper. And, you know, I don't think I've ever felt as much comic sympathy for a villain.
Exactly. That's why I mention that anyone who tries to put a villain at the center of a piece of fiction has to stand in the shadow of John Falstaff. That Shakespeare gave us the rhetorical means, the way you can live with a scoundrel in literature is now and then to make the scoundrel the victim and this comic victim. So that's one way of doing it. The other great master and the other great tutorial, if you like, in how to do this comes from John Updike. Now, John Updike's rabbit, Harry Angstrom, is not a particularly nice guy. He's not very clever. His educational opportunities have been rather small. He's a limited consciousness. And yet, Updike can filter the whole of 40 years of American social history plus an intricate personal life through this man. So how do we come to live with Harry so long? For a rabbit. Well, I think it's a rhetorical trick. Updike gives him thoughts that such a man would never have, could never have. So behind these two masters, I made my own humble contribution.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with the wonderful Ian McEwan. You know, you've probably read Atonement. He's the author, most recently, of Songer, published by Doubleday. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ian McEwan about his darkly comic novel, Songer. It melds domestic satire and satire of scientific society, end of the world, people who benefit, who profit from the end of the world. The book traces the ambitions and self-deception of Michael Beard, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and womanizer who has cheated on every one of his many wives. Now, that's a sub-theme of this book and one that you seem to share with what I hear Martin Amis is writing, the aftermath of several generations of women's liberation.
I think my concerns diverge a little from Martin's. Maybe there's an argument still carrying over here from Chesil Beach. What are the consequences of that great warming and relaxing of human relationships that took place in the 60s? Many of, if not most of them, were positive. But there are some downsides. In many ways, the sexual revolution of the 60s was one that benefited men far more than women. And actually, the women's movement was in part a reaction against the liberties and freedoms that men were grabbing for themselves. So there is a little moment here when, having got the girl with the Milton, Michael Beard then marries her, and she becomes a radical feminist of the kind that I don't think you meet them now, but they were very much around in the, say, about 1969, 1970. And men stood amazed and dazed, like like figures in the headlights of an approaching car, with no idea of the arguments, how to deal with it. So there's, a little bit of bedroom comedy around this matter.
Well, the next generation comes along, and he's attacked by a woman who notices that his attitudes toward gender in the laboratory are not the best.
There is an enormous amount of work on the difference between men and women's brains in development and so on, with some conclusions saying that women are better at language and men are better at rotating objects in mental space. I mean, we've heard it all before. But it's very hard to actually have an empirical debate about this, because it's so impacted with politics and the is and the oughts get wrapped up. And I thought, here is a wonderful parallel with climate change. And instead of simply saying, well, we don't know what's happening, let's get more empirical data and find out, people take on positions which are almost like religious faiths. And the parallels of those two intrigued me. So I thought, I know what, I'll let Michael Beard step out of his area of competence and make some pronouncements. And then I can also have fun with the press, because I remember, too, what happened to James Watson when he made some injudicious remarks about race and intelligence. Well, they were remarks I don't think anyone could defend, but the press went into a kind of ecstasy of indignation about it. There's fun to be had with that, too, a little bit of tease.
Now, what is the impulse to tease? Because you really are teasing the culture, and if, as you point out in an article you've done, I think in The Guardian, if it's mostly women who read, it seems to me that there's a certain amount in the current British novel of woman baiting.
Well, not in this novel. If anything, this is a man baiting novel. It's certainly the case that I think the novel would die if women stopped reading. I think it is a feminine form. Its origins in the 18th century were that too. I conducted a little bit of empirical investigation of my own. I went out with my son. We took 100 paperback books we were trying to get rid of. We had hardback versions or duplicate versions. We went out into the square where our house is, where everybody's having their picnic lunches. Office workers from all around central London come and sit in the gardens. And we went round saying, would you like a free book? Would you like to choose from this great pile of books? All contemporary novels, all of them good. Actually, some of them were mine even. And we could not give a single book to a man. Not one man would take a book. And it took us 40 minutes to get rid of all the books. Every woman that we approached said, oh, can I take three? Can I take four? Or I've read that, I'll have that one. But the men, it was just amazing. So I wrote it up, The Guardian, as just a little experiment.
Now, I'm talking to Ian McEwan about Solar, and I think we've uncovered an exciting divergence in this novel. The novel seems to show us why, although we may find the things to do about global warming, we are not going to find what will rescue us from human nature.
No, we're trapped in our nature. That's for sure. I don't know if you followed the events at Copenhagen in December last year. Probably historically unprecedented that science, rationality, if you like, should gather the nations of the earth together, 192 nations in one city. Governments who didn't really want to be there, but they just, you know, they knew they had to be there. And then what happens? Some other part of our human nature, not our cleverness, but our tendency to short-termism, to cabals, to self-interest, got in the way. That's why at the end of this novel, Michael Beard is invited to Copenhagen. This novel ends in August of 2009, and he gets an email right towards the end saying, would you come and address a meeting of foreign ministers? And he thinks, yes, that's just the place for me.
Well, it's lovely because the novel has as well an appendix which causes one to feel real sorrow, because it's like Hamlet's soliloquy, what a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculties. What we have is a simulation of the speech that was given when the Nobel Prize Committee gave our character, Michael Beard, his Nobel Prize. And what a good man he was.
Well, I have to say, I'm pleased you're praising that bit, because it's the only bit of the novel I didn't write. I was in the Galapagos last year, and I met a Cambridge, England, mathematician and physicist. And we started talking, and I realized that I was in the company of a man who loved intellectual mischief. And I said, look, I've just finished this novel. Would you read the typescript? And would then you please reverse engineer for me the precise work that Michael Beard did, because I don't really know. I just call it the Beard-Einstein conflation. Would you reverse engineer his work and write the citation from Stockholm that he received? So we looked at a few citations, and you can go on the Nobel Stockholm site. They're slightly jokey. They're for the layman. And so Graham Mitchison, now a new friend, set about writing the citation and did it brilliantly again, and evoked Richard Feynman and invented, you know, some plausible mathematics. And I was able to then to go back and put these things into the novel, the things that he put in his in the appendix, I then put into the novel. So it's very lucky for me.
He gives us then the sweeter, younger, thinner Michael Beard, the person that time and selfishness and our culture has caused to slacken. If there is a victimization in this book, it seems to be that human genius is the victim of culture as much as the rest of us are.
I think it's a reciprocal matter. I mean, remember in the appendix, Graham has Richard Feynman breaking up a meeting in 1972, waving the paper of a young PhD student, saying he's done it, he's solved it. So Michael Beard is off stage at this point. It's Feynman who discovers Michael Beard. And yes, you have to think back to a time to a rather, still rather portly fellow with a row of pens in his top pocket, very unfashionably dressed in a tweed sports coat in 1968, and a SWAT, you know, and a really hardworking guy who knows how to fix things, always at the front of every queue, every line, always has tickets to the Cream concert, always, you know, knows the social and political landscape and get his way through. So from the start, I mean, one mustn't romanticize, he was quite a wised-up guy from the age of 20.
And the final question, why mustn't one romanticize?
Michael Beard, why must one not romanticize him? I think he had a vein of greed and ambition, unpleasant ambition, right from the start. But I still, for all I've said, having journeyed with him for 3 years myself, learned to love him. And I guess we all must if we're going to tolerate ourselves.
I've been talking with Ian McEwan, author most recently of Solar, published by Doubleday. Thank you for joining me, Ian.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Solar at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with assistance today from J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.